The following program is produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.
What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Reach.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Rabbi Jamie Korngold, the Adventure Rabbi, and author of the new book, The God Upgrade. We'll also have visits from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. Too Jewish is sponsored this morning by Temple Emmanuel, a Reformed Jewish community for all of Tucson. Call 327-4501 for information on Arizona's finest synagogue, the only full-service Reformed congregation in southern Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. There are some days when there is just way too much to talk about on one radio show, and this is one of those mornings. In addition to the fact that I have just been in Israel on a truly whirlwind trip sponsored by the Israeli Foreign Ministry and the World Zionist Organization, basically it consisted of two 24-hour days of flying back and forth for a total of three very intense and wonderful days in Israel. I have a huge amount to tell you about from that extraordinary experience. And, oh, by the way, there has also been a little bit of news about Israel. First, Palestinian West Bank Fatah President Mahmoud Abbas published a controversial op-ed in the New York Times about Palestinian statehood, in which he called for a state of Palestine now in order to continue the fight against Israel by other means. Then, U.S. President Barack Obama delivered an hour-long address on the Middle East that was even more controversial, in which he explicitly said Israel would have to pull back more or less within the 1967 borders. And then Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu arrived in Washington, met with Barack Obama. Together they released a bunch of statements. And then Netanyahu addressed a joint session of Congress. And then both of them spoke separately at the AIPAC conference in Washington. Otherwise, nothing much has happened since I recorded the last Too Jewish radio show. So, since it will be basically impossible to cover everything this morning, I'll stretch this out over a few weeks, but I'll start with the Ikar, the heart of the political matter. Everybody has been talking about Obama saying last week that Israel would need to get used to living within approximately the 1967 borders again in order to ultimately allow for a two-state solution, Israel and Palestine. The president then added a crucial small phrase with some adjustments, but most of the heat generated came from him seeming to endorse a Palestinian position that everything outside the 67 borders of Israel, which were basically armistice lines from the end of the 48 War of Independence, had to become Palestine. Prime Minister Netanyahu responded when he arrived in Washington the next day by saying that the 67 borders are indefensible. He highlighted that again briefly in his address to Congress. At the AIPAC conference, the biggest pro-Israel convention in the world and the most politically important, Obama seemed to backpedal a bit and Netanyahu more or less didn't. Otherwise, the meetings and speeches and so on highlighted the overwhelming strength of the U.S.-Israel relationship and the many areas of close agreement. But that's a bit like saying, and aside from that, Mrs. Lincoln, how was the theater? So, here's the quick Rabbi Kohan Too Jewish analysis. First, there is no crisis in U.S.-Israel relations. It's apparent that Obama and Netanyahu don't get along very well, which is too bad, and that there are some differences on what will help the situation in the Middle East. But in general, all the hand-wringing and hysterical editorials are misguided. The U.S. government's official position for many years has been that Israel would eventually have to withdraw from most of the land captured in the defensive 1967 Six-Day War. They would do so in exchange for a real and durable peace, ensured by strong security measures and a demilitarized Palestinian entity. There was always an understanding, made more or less explicit, that there would be some land swaps that would keep Israeli neighborhoods, like most of the Jerusalem municipal area, in Israel, and give the Palestinians some land from perhaps even pre-67 Israel that contained primarily Arab villages. This has been the U.S.'s policy for several administrations. By the way, the U.S. is not planning on giving back to Mexico all the land it captured in the Mexican War, but, well, never mind that. Anyway, in addition, with the exception of the urban areas around Jerusalem and a few major West Bank towns like Ariel, ever since the First Intifada began in 1987, and certainly since the Second Intifada began way back in September of 2000, Israel has been living mostly within the 67 borders, with just a few exceptions, namely Jerusalem, particularly the Old City, which Israel will never and should never give up, the Golan Heights, which no one in his or her right mind would suggest giving to Syria right now, while Bashar Assad is conducting genocide against his own citizens, and a few Israeli settlements in the West Bank, and maybe just sort of outer Tel Aviv. There is really nothing revolutionary about Obama's statements in his Middle East address, coming in the last part of an hour-long declaration about the whole Middle East, a speech that tried to move the U.S. to the front of the Arab winter, Arab spring democracy movement, and also tried to reposition America leading the situation instead of following behind, you know, being proactive and not just reactive. Obama's comments on Israel and the Palestinians seemed designed to restart a moribund, well, frankly, dead peace effort that he has been trying to initiate for a couple of years. What was extraordinary, and not in a good way, about Obama's speech was that he chose to deliver that message so publicly just before Netanyahu got to Washington. Not an accident. For a president who has been accused of being too nuanced, too little inclined to lead, this was not nuanced at all. He was kind of hitting Netanyahu in the head with a hammer, albeit an old rubber-coated hammer. And so, in effect, Netanyahu gently hit back. First, he addressed a joint session of Congress in Washington, an honor not given as often as you might think. The annual average of joint sessions is between 2 and 6 a year in the last decade. So in a truly stirring, eloquent speech, Netanyahu received not less than 26 standing ovations from the combined House and Senate. While I am not really a fan of Benjamin Netanyahu's, I must say that this one was an excellent speech. He addressed not only the president's comments about Israel, but drew in a much larger way on the depth of the commitments between Israel and America. As Netanyahu said, Israel has no better friend than America, and America has no better friend than Israel. We stand together to defend democracy. We stand together to advance peace. We stand together to fight terrorism. In an unstable Middle East, Israel is the one anchor of stability. In a region of shifting alliances, Israel is America's unwavering ally. Israel has always been pro-American. Israel will always be pro-American. Okay, nice words. But then he went on to say, my friends, you don't need to do nation building in Israel. We're already built. You don't need to export democracy to Israel. We've already got it. You don't need to send American troops to defend Israel. We defend ourselves. You've been very generous giving us tools to do the job of defending Israel on our own. Thank you all. Thank you, President Obama, for your steadfast commitment to Israel's security. I know economic times are tough. I deeply appreciate this. All very accurate, all very positive. And then Bibi took up the theme of the dramatic changes in the Arab world. Netanyahu said, support for Israel's security is a wise investment in our common future. An epic battle is now unfolding in the Middle East between tyranny and freedom. A great convulsion is shaking the earth from the Khyber Pass to the Straits of Gibraltar. The tremors have shattered states and toppled governments. And we can all see that the ground is still shifting. Now, this historic moment holds the promise of a new dawn of freedom and opportunity. Millions of young people are determined to change their future. We all look to them. They muster courage. They risk their lives. They demand dignity. They desire liberty. Wow. Well, Netanyahu was better than anything Obama said on the same subject a couple of days before. He was eloquent and powerful. I must admit that while I was in Israel last week, we spent a day and a half at the foreign ministry getting briefed by a series of real experts, spent some time at the Israeli Supreme Court meeting with the Chief Justice, met at the Knesset with three important members, and so on. No one, and I mean no one, from cab drivers to cabinet ministers, had anything positive to say about the revolutionary changes in the Arab world in the past 6 months. Everybody in Israel seems suspicious that what would follow would be either new military dictatorships, just like the old deposed ones, or radical Islamist states. None of Netanyahu's hopeful words were reflected on the Israeli street or in the halls of democratic authority. But still, Bibi Netanyahu said this. Good for him. And then he said, talking about Israel, we have a free press, independent courts, an open economy, rambunctious parliamentary debates. You think you guys are tough on one another in Congress? Come spend a day in the Knesset. Be my guest. Courageous Arab protesters are struggling to secure these very same rights for their peoples, for their societies. We're proud that over 1 million Arab citizens of Israel enjoy these rights and have for decades. Of the 300 million Arabs in the Middle East and North Africa, only Israel's Arab citizens enjoy real democratic rights. Stop for a second and think about that. Of those 300 million Arabs, less than 0.5% are truly free, and they're all citizens of Israel. This startling fact reveals a basic truth. Israel is not what is wrong about the Middle East. Israel is what is right about the Middle East. Israel fully supports the desire of Arab peoples in our region to live freely. We long for the day when Israel will be one of many real democracies in the Middle East. Good stuff, indeed. In general, certainly true, whatever we think about the full rights of Arab citizens of Israel. Democracies, the old adage goes, don't go to war against other democracies, at least not very often. And democracies don't seek to kill each other's innocent civilians and children. If the Arab countries actually really emerge as democracies eventually, it will be a very different and much better Middle East. Provided, of course, that the democracies don't then elect radical Islamist governments. After all, remember, Hitler was elected by a German democracy. In any case, Netanyahu went on to clinch it. He said, 2 years ago, I publicly committed to a solution of two states for two peoples, a Palestinian state alongside the Jewish state. I am willing to make painful compromises to achieve this historic peace. As a leader of Israel, it is my responsibility to lead my people to peace. So, Netanyahu asks, if Israel is willing to accept a Palestinian state, why isn't there one already? Because the Palestinians have not accepted the existence of a Jewish state that has now been around for 63 years. They were simply unwilling to end the conflict, he said, and I regret to say this. They continue to educate their children to hate. They continue to name public squares after terrorists. Worst of all, they continue to perpetuate the fantasy that Israel will one day be flooded by the descendants of Palestinian refugees. My friends, this must come to an end. President Abbas must do what I have already done. I stood before my people and I told you it wasn't easy for me, and I said I will accept a Palestinian state. It is time for President Abbas to stand before his people and say, I will accept a Jewish state. Those six words will change history. They will make it clear to the Palestinians that this conflict must come to an end. That they are not building a state to continue the conflict with Israel, but to end it. They will convince the people of Israel that they have a true partner for peace. With such a partner, the people of Israel will be prepared to make a far-reaching compromise. I will be prepared to make a far-reaching compromise. And Netanyahu finished, peace can be achieved only around the negotiating table. The Palestinian attempt to impose a settlement through the United Nations will not bring peace. It should be forcefully opposed by all those who want to see this conflict end. I appreciate the president's clear position on this issue. Peace cannot be imposed. It must be negotiated. But it can only be negotiated with partners committed to peace. Okay, so Netanyahu made quite a speech. Now, What he actually believes or does may be quite different. He is, after all, a politician and one with a well-deserved reputation for, shall we say, smoothness. But the real issue, Netanyahu delineated, was dead right. And it was made clear when President Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, said in his op-ed in the New York Times earlier that week that the reason it was time for the Palestinians to have a state, one they have refused to have many times in the past, by the way, was so they could have an additional leverage to use against Israel. And when Abbas, after Netanyahu's speech, said, there's nothing new there. You know, the truth is you don't proclaim a new state so that you can attack another. You proclaim a new state so that your people can have self-determination. You proclaim a new state so you can better serve the needs and legitimate positive aspirations of your people. You don't proclaim a new state to try to overcome another legitimate state. Finally, in tribute to the legitimate 63-year-old democratic successful nation of the Middle East, Israel, here is Israeli singer Aviv Geffen singing Bishvilech.
איך את מרגישה? האם את עדיין רק שלי? לפעמים אני פוחד קצת לאבד אותך פתאום. איך אני משתדל תמיד למלא לך כל משאלה שלא יהיה לך בלב. בשבילך, בשבילך יהיה לנו קשה, אך גם מזה נצא. את לא תהיי לבד לעולם. בשבילך, בשבילך ניפול אל התהום, אבל בסוף היום אנוח בחיקך. צד אל צד הפרחים שבך בין כל הקוצים שבי מנסים לגדול ביחד, מחפשים מקום שקט. מחפשים מקום שקט.
That was Bishvilech for you from Israeli singer Aviv Geffen. There is a lot more to say about Israel, and I'll do so over the next several weeks. The one point I have to make is that Israel seems to be doing extremely well right now, succeeding economically, socially, artistically, and culturally from everything I saw. Remains to be seen how Israel does in this new political and propaganda climate, but you know something? Don't worry so much. In another area altogether, when we return on Too Jewish, we'll meet Rabbi Jamie Korngold, the adventure rabbi and a darn fine skier, and find out just what a God upgrade is when we come back on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. You know, most of the time I'm talking about the great pizza we serve at Mama's, but not today. Nope. Today I want to tell you about our calzones. A calzone is kind of like a stuffed pizza. It's made of dough wrapped around whatever ingredients you want, like pepperoni, mushrooms, or even artichoke hearts. There's lots of cheese inside, and it's served with a cup of marinara sauce. Our calzones are huge. We had a guy order two of them over the phone, and when he picked them up, he couldn't believe it. There were only two people eating, and two large calzones feed 6 to 8 people easy. You know, it wouldn't hurt you to try a calzone next time you're in. Then, if they get real popular, we might have to change our name to Mama's Calzones. Mama's Pizza, 4500 East Speedway in the Midway Business Park, on the east side of 22nd and Colb and back at the Fry Shopping Center, on the north side at the southwest corner of Oracle and McGee, and on newest at Broadway and Houghton. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza!
Tucson Hebrew Academy is an independent school for children from kindergarten through 8th grade. It has a long-standing track record of academic excellence and an unparalleled integrated general and Judaic studies curriculum with a variety of music and fine arts classes combined with the award-winning sports program THA nourishes students in body, mind, and spirit. The atmosphere in the classroom encourages self-assured self-expression, critical thinking skills, and respect for diverse points of view. THA's low student-teacher ratio allows its highly qualified faculty to provide instruction based on the most up-to-date proven research methods in science, technology, math, and literature. THA students understand the relevance of Jewish values in the modern world. THA sees learning as a way of life and builds a strong sense of community. They are enrolling now. Please give your child the gift of a THA education. For more information on how to enroll your child and to schedule a tour, call 529-3888 or visit thaaz.org. That's 529-3888 for THA. We're delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our good friend, Rabbi Jamie Korngold. She's the adventure rabbi, famous for her encounters with nature, who has a new book out called The God Upgrade. Good morning, Jamie.
Rabbi Kohan, it's such a delight to be with you again today.
Always a pleasure. So tell me a little bit how you get from the books you've written so far, which often have to do with engaging nature, engaging the world in a different way, to The God Upgrade.
It's a great question. I love to talk about the connection between the two books. Doesn't seem obvious, but there is a strong connection. What I discovered is I wrote my first book, God in the Wilderness, and that got people really excited about coming back to their Judaism because I presented Judaism in a way that was very accessible to them. And what I found is people came back to Judaism in droves, and they arrived at synagogue, and they opened up the prayer book where they heard the congregation reading or the rabbi speaking, and they said, wait a second. This still doesn't work for me. This language about God watching over us like a shepherd watches over his sheep, I don't believe that. I don't think there's a place here for me. And they quickly left again.
So they needed a different access point.
What I realized is that those of us that go to synagogue frequently kind of have an understanding of what we're talking about. It's sort of like maybe we're talking in code, but if you don't come regularly, some of what we say just sounds, it doesn't make sense to people. It sounds irrational. It sounds like we're asking them to believe something that, you know, they don't believe there's a God up in the sky that's making things happen. And so a lot of people feel like there's no place in religion for them. So that's what I was trying to do, is to say, wait a second. Maybe that's not exactly what's going on here. Let's talk more freely and openly about this subject of God. What do we really believe? What are we really saying?
So what do we, or at least you, really believe? What are we really trying to say?
This is the interesting piece, is that the reality is that the Jewish concept of God has changed drastically over the centuries. It's not static at all. And I like to think of it as upgrades, that as our situation in the world has changed, as we've come to understand the world around us better, we've actually changed our understanding of the nature of God. And so part of what I do in the book is actually I lay out these different theologians and I call them upgrades. So it's kind of fun. And then I suggest that, you know, we need to have open conversations based on all these different theologies and our understanding of the world and come up with something that works for ourselves. The website for the God Upgrade has a great, it's a lovely painting, I love it. It's this great old-fashioned sailing ship, and it's poised to go off the end of the Earth, because that's what happened when sailing ships went to the end of the Earth when it was flat. And then it morphs into a photograph of the Hubble Space Telescope. And what I'm trying to portray is that we have upgraded our understanding of the world. And if we don't also upgrade our understanding of God, then what happens is people think that religion is all this mumbo jumbo and they just throw the whole thing out. I think that Judaism truly makes our lives more meaningful, builds community in unique ways, and gives us a pathway to live our lives so that our lives don't feel empty and lonely. And so it pains me to think that people will toss out our entire religion because of this piece. I mean, it's strange to say, but I feel like the biggest stumbling block to religion is God.
We will explore that question and see how we can get to religion and to Judaism with Rabbi Jamie Korngold when we come back on Too Jewish.
Choosing the proper care for your mother, father, or other loved one isn't easy. David Shackman and his wife, Ann, are New Yorkers who recently found a home at Handmaker, Tucson's premier provider of assisted living and senior care.
I'm 88 years old. My wife is 86. And we like staying at Handmaker because people here are very courteous and the atmosphere is nice.
Well, I like the program here because they have entertainers, have a bingo. They made a luau with Hawaiian dances.
Handmaker gives their son, Ken, peace of mind.
I know that they are going to get good service and the staff will treat them as friends.
Handmaker, centrally located on Rosemont just south of Grant, includes one and two bedroom suites, cozy studios with patios and balconies, and Tucson's most caring staff. Call 881-2323.
The food here is excellent. It's as good as any good restaurant in New York City.
For a consultation and tour, call 881-2323 or go to handmaker.org.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or call 520-327-4501 or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can get CDs of the past and present shows by contacting us through the website or downloading us from twojewishradio.com or at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular podcasts. We welcome our maven, our expert on Israel, Guy Gelbart, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Good morning, Guy.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Recently, Hamas and Fatah signed a kind of a peace treaty between them, a coexistence agreement. Not too long ago, Hamas was throwing Fatah guys off the top of buildings, and now they're going to be in a government together. Some Israeli Knesset members, Arab members of Knesset, attended the ceremony. I believe that Hamas is kind of persona non grata as an organization. Not all Israelis really can have any interaction with them legally, even. How does that affect members of Knesset?
Well, first of all, we need to acknowledge that Hamas is a terrorist organization, and it's well known for its terrorist attacks and also defined as a terrorist organization here in the U.S. Regardless of that, parliament members, Knesset members in Israel, are immune from legal
actions
of any kind, and it's essential for Israel in order to keep its democracy. So while many people in the public are not happy with seeing parliament members going and meeting with terrorists or going to a ceremony that is held by terrorists, we do respect the fact that as parliament members, they have the right sometimes to do things that are illegal because we want them to be able to have a voice.
Do you think that there's going to be any durability to this Hamas-Fatah agreement?
I must admit that I think it's, in my personal perspective, I think it's mainly to the mouth and out. It's mainly in order to show the Western world as if they are united. But it appears that in Gaza, the Hamas is the one running the show. And currently in Judah and Samaria, the Fatah is the one running the show. And I hope the Hamas won't take control over those regions as well. It does bring into mind the fact that Hamas is feeling a little weak in coming and doing this agreement with Fatah.
the interesting change, and you know, with the sort of decline of Al-Qaeda, maybe there's some increased pressure on Iran, all of this big Arab Spring in which all the dictators are either toppling or shaking or moving around to try to dodge, you know, uprisings. I wonder if that also undermines something like an organization like Hamas.
I think the main thing that it brings to mind is that suddenly people are aware that the main human rights issues in the Middle East has nothing to do with Israel. They have to do with their own dark regimes and their dictatorships. And Hamas is not different than others. They're treating their own people extremely badly. And, you know, they have their reasons. They wanted to show good on TV for the West world, but they're not nice to their own people. They're not taking care of basic needs of their people.
Thanks, Guy. We will continue to talk next week.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
We visit weekly with the great restaurateur Janos Wilder of Janos Restaurant, the J Bar in Downtown Kitchen and Cocktails, who was just again named a semifinalist for the National James Beard Award for Chef of the Year.
That's right. Good morning, Rabbi. Thank you so much.
Good morning and mazel tov. What's cooking at Janos now?
Well, all sorts of fun things. It's springtime, so this is when my restaurants come into their own, when we get all the new flavors from the gardeners, from baby beets to little peas to citrus. Wonderful things for us to cook with. The menus are light. They're fun. We're doing our 10 terrific taste menu year-round now at Janos, which is actually a misnomer. It's 12 different things over 4 courses. Lots of little mouthfuls of great tastes.
You know, my wife Wendy calls your food magic food.
That's so nice of her to say that. If I cook magic food, the place I do it is at Janos. That's where we pull out all the stops, and that's where it's really, that's the height of the cooking that I do.
What's the phone number for Janos?
615-6100.
Or www.janos.com. Thanks, Janos.
Thank you, Rabbi.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been discussing and debating the impact of the Osama bin Laden death, and of course, the question that keeps coming up, being Jews and on the show Too Jewish, what does it mean for the Jews? What does it mean for Israel? Anything?
Well, those are probably two different questions. In terms of Israel, I don't know that it makes a great deal of difference for Israel's national security. I think that all the developments in the Arab world in particular, since Israel is surrounded by Arab countries, and in the Islamic world in general, have at least a long-term impact on Israel's security. And I think that the more free and democratic and transparent the Arab world becomes, the safer Israel is in the long term. There can be lots of bumps along that road. I also think that a serious blow to an organization like Al-Qaeda is probably good for Israel because Al-Qaeda's operations in neighboring countries may be ratcheted down a notch or two in the absence of leadership, while there may be an internal struggle in Al-Qaeda for leadership, while Al-Qaeda may have to relocate its headquarters. All that stuff may at least temporarily cause a little bit of a ratcheting down of operations and operational preparedness. So the short-term benefit of killing Osama is probably there to some extent for Israel. Long-term, because Israel is seen as the American bridgehead in the Middle East and the American presence, and rightly or wrongly, many Arabs perceive Israel as being an American puppet. So if they can't get back at us, for killing Osama bin Laden. They may try to get back at Israel and strike at Israel in some way. So, you know, in the long term, Israel needs to be as alert as ever to protect her citizens and her national security and the security of her shoreline, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, Israel's never been a very safe place, and this incident is not likely to make it safer in the long run. In the very short term, it may, because of the factors I indicated earlier. But, you know, this incident happens at a very interesting time in the Muslim world. And I think a lot of Muslims are engaged in a lot of reassessing right now, if not to say soul searching, looking at where their own countries are, where they are in terms of their countries, and where their countries are in terms of their relationships with the U.S. And I think a lot of reassessment is going on now and will continue to go on for the coming months.
Yeah, it's been a very interesting and very complicated 4 or 5, even 6 months in the Middle East and that whole region. Thanks, Tom. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
And now it's time for the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. On the sixth day, God turned to the angels and said, "Today I'm going to create a land called Israel, a land of beautiful hills and even snow-capped mountains, sparkling lakes, forests full of all kinds of trees, high cliffs overlooking sandy ocean beaches with an abundance of sea life." Then God continued, "I will make the land rich so as to make the inhabitants prosper. I shall call these inhabitants Israelis, and they shall be known to all the peoples on earth." "But Lord," asked the angels, "don't you think you're being too generous to these Israelis?" "Not really," God replied. "Wait and see the neighbors I'm going to give them." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we chant the second portion from the book of Numbers, Naso, including a remarkable blessing, the Birkat Kohanim. The priestly blessing is really three distinct brachot, three separate prayers, with which the ancient priests were commanded to bless the people. From its inception, this three-part blessing had exceptional importance, as the Torah quotes God saying, "With this blessing you will place my name on the people of Israel, v'samu et shemi." That is, this very blessing conveys God's presence among us and offers God's protection. The blessing was given by the Kohanim, highest class of priests, those who were entrusted with the service of the tabernacle and the temple. We still use this blessing at every joyous life cycle event, and it remains powerful. The text is, "May God bless you and guard you. May the light of God's presence shine on you and be gracious to you. May God's presence turn to you and grant you peace." In essence, the Birkat Kohanim asks God to supply our most important needs. The majority of the interpretations of this portion see the first blessing as a request for physical safety and health, the second asking for material needs to be satisfied, and a third blessing seeking spiritual comfort and confidence. Without any one of those blessings, our lives become challenging. With all three, we are assured real quality in our lives. After thousands of years, these three elements, safety, grace, and peace, remain central for us and a gift from God. May you be blessed with each of these, with all of these, this week and always. When we come back, we'll talk with Rabbi Jamie Korngold, the adventure rabbi, author of the new book, The God Upgrade, about what it means to upgrade God exactly, and hear one of the great Too Jewish stories of all time. Just a few moments on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
French political star Dominique Strauss-Kahn resigned as managing director of the International Monetary Fund following his arrest and imprisonment on charges of sexual assault in New York. In a statement on the IMF website, the popular left-leaning political figure was expected to run for the French presidency in 2012 said, "It is with infinite sadness I feel compelled today to present to the executive board my resignation from my post of managing director of the IMF." Strauss-Kahn, who is of course Jewish, was taken off a Paris-bound flight at Kennedy on May 14th, arrested on charges of raping a maid in his New York City hotel room that day. In the statement, Strauss-Kahn said, "I think at this time first of my wife, of my children, of my family, of my friends," and he claimed innocence. "I deny with the greatest possible firmness all the allegations that have been made against me. I want to protect this institution, which I have served with honor and devotion, and especially I want to devote all my strength, all my time, and all my energy to proving my innocence." Recent polls repeatedly showed that Dominique Strauss-Kahn was considered more popular than current French President Nicolas Sarkozy and the most likely political opponent to unseat him in the next election. Bloggers and pundits even mused on the fact that France might be led by a Jewish president if Strauss-Kahn won, for the first time since the 30s. All of that changed with his arrest, the emergence of other women who claimed he had also assaulted them. Ugh. Palestinian Authority Prime Minister Salem Fayyad was released from a Texas hospital, where he was admitted for chest pains. He was released from the Seton Medical Center in Austin 2 days after undergoing a heart catheterization to open a blocked artery. Fayyad is 59 years old. He did not suffer a heart attack, as was originally reported. Fayyad, reportedly a heavy smoker, was in Texas for his son's college graduation. Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu, in his speech to Congress, wished Fayyad a speedy recovery. An American-educated economist, Fayyad has enjoyed good relations with the U.S. and other Western countries. The Egyptian newspaper Al Aram, citing unnamed sources, reported last week that he will not be allowed to stay on as prime minister in a new Palestinian Fatah-Hamas unity government. There have been reports he might serve the next government as finance minister, a post he has held in previous Palestinian governments. And finally, Murray Handworker, who helped grow Nathan's Famous from his father's Coney Island hot dog stand into a national franchise, passed away last week at the age of 89. Handworker's father, Nathan, opened the Coney Island stand in 1916, 4 years after he came here from Poland. Murray was born 5 years later, in 1921, and spent so much time in the restaurant, he came to regard Frankfurter bun boxes as his playpen. Murray went on to work in nearly every aspect of the business, from stacking pallets of hot dogs to manning the grill at Nathan's. As a teenager, Murray told his son later, he sometimes worked the grill so long he had trouble standing up. Seeing the appeal that Nathan's hot dogs had, Handworker returned from the Army in World War II with a broader worldview, new ideas on how to expand the business. His father always insisted had to be a single stand on Coney Island. Nathan's eventually became a fixture all around. The hot dogs were even flown to a London party for Barbara Streisand. Murray Handworker expanded the restaurant first within New York, then outside the region, set up franchises, and took the company public. And he put its hot dogs on supermarket shelves all around the country. He sold out in 1987, but the brand lives on. Bill Handworker said his father enjoyed hot dogs to the very end of his life and had one for lunch not long before his death. And Murray always ate his Nathan's Frankfurters the same, his son said,
au naturel. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Rabbi Jamie Korngold, the Adventure Rabbi. She has a new book out called The God Upgrade, follow-up on her successful God in the Wilderness book. And we were talking earlier about how the language we use, the images we use for God, can be a barrier to religion. I want to talk about a totally different subject of connectivity. You sent me a great story about contacting Amazon and a Two Jewish story. So can you share that with our listeners?
Oh, this is such a fun story. Amazon has this amazing part of their website that they've built for authors where we can go see how many books we've sold and where we've sold them, and we can input all these different reviews. And I was having a little trouble with it. So there's a button you can push that says, have someone call me now. And so I pushed that button, and like a miracle, 2 seconds later, literally, my phone rings. And this man says, hello, my name is Patrick. He's on the phone. He's calling me. And he says, I can see on my screen that you're Rabbi Jamie Korngold, and how can I help you? And then he says to me, I have to ask you something. Are you the rabbi that wrote God in the Wilderness? Because I think I heard you on Rabbi Kohan's radio show a few years ago. Was that you? And he proceeded to tell me how he loves your show, and I think he lives in Illinois. He's like, I never miss it. And he said, and I love the program when you were on talking about God in the Wilderness, and I listen to it all the time when I mow my lawn.
Wow.
So it was like a miracle on three fronts. One, that like I asked for help, I got it immediately. Two, he knew who I was. And three, he had actually heard the show and heard you and me talking and was so loved the way that you dig into topics on your show that he listens to it repeatedly.
That's stunning. So it must be a very well-trimmed lawn. I mean, that's sort of taking God out into the wilderness and turning it into civilization. It's a great story. Thank you for sharing that, Jamie. So, by the way, every now and then I introduce you as the best skiing rabbi in the history of Judaism.
I love that.
I'm pretty sure that's true. You have any doubts on that subject?
Oh, I don't know. Well, there's some pretty good rabbinical skiers out there, but it could be. I do love to ski.
You're the only one I know who is nationally ranked. That's all I can say.
I think that, for me, so much of my Jewish experience has to do with saying to people that you don't have to just put your Judaism inside the synagogue, and also you don't have to just have it at home, that Judaism can inform the everyday parts of our lives. So for me, whether it's skiing or mowing your lawn, those are all opportunities for Jewish experiences.
So when people come into the synagogue, because part of God in the Wilderness, taking people out into the wilderness to find God, part of the God upgrade is finding a way for people to connect in other settings. What kinds of images of God are useful, or what kinds of language do you think is useful in this God upgrade concept?
I think that one of the real problems that we have in synagogue life is vocabulary. Like when we use words like awe and spiritual, and like, what do those words mean? I think it's kind of hard to use those words without sounding kind of hokey. And one of the things that's so powerful about taking Judaism outside is when you're standing on a mountaintop, it's really easy to know what awe means. I mean, you experience it. And then when you move it back inside, now the vocabulary makes sense.
So, and having skied with you and feeling great pride that I could hang for like at least half a day before I was too exhausted to keep going, there's awe, and it includes a little fear on a mountain sometimes, no matter how good you are. There's stuff that's kind of scary. Do we have an aversion to that sense of fear or humility that's part of awe?
I think it can be difficult for us. Like when we're talking about God and we're talking about Yirah, that awe, that mixture of awe and fear, I think the language just doesn't ring true for people anymore. And I think we are working really hard in our synagogue services to recreate that. But, I think you know, it used to be that the idea of God writing down all our sins, you know, that was scary. That was fearful. Now we just think it's, oh, come on. God's not up there writing down all my sins.
So, you know, the notion of, you know, a Sefer Chaim and a plus and minus ledger and all that stuff does seem awfully primitive. How do we upgrade our conception of God and understand these words as metaphors, or do we just have to come up with a whole new language?
So these are the really key questions. And I've been on a book tour all over the country, and I'm always touring when people ask me what my concept of God is, whether or not I should talk about it or not. Because I feel like the purpose of my book really is to start a conversation. And it's not to convince people that what I think is the right theology, but it's to get people to start talking about their own theologies. And I've been really touched by something that's been going on the Reform Rabbis listserv. In right around Passover, I had an op-ed piece that was published in the Washington Post. And in it, I said, we can't possibly hope to teach our children a coherent concept of God if we as parents don't know what we believe. And I challenged people to add a new question at their Passover Seder, which is, what do you believe about the nature of God? And then I posted this on the rabbinic listserv. And still today, I mean, it's almost a month and a half or 2 months later, the rabbis are still discussing this. And they're digging in and talking about, what do I believe? What, you know, and thank you for asking. No one really asks. You know, there's no safe forums for us to really discuss what we believe. So the hope for my book, I think, is that this will serve as a springboard for people to really launch into deeper conversations with their families, with their rabbis, with their friends, and explore what it is that we believe. And then what do we do with that? I mean, if we're going to upgrade God, then Judaism gets this big upgrade too.
And then it can speak to different people. You know, I sometimes think that the only people we talk about, what do you believe God is? Who do you think God is? What do you think God is? The only people who really get a chance to discuss that in organized Judaism are teenagers getting ready for confirmation, or, you know, maybe a bar bat mitzvah kid who seems kind of bright. We don't really talk about that with adults.
It's scary. I think we're all scared that, not all of us, many of us are scared that if we say what we really believe, we'll be showed the door. Like we're the only person there. That's.
I'm the only one who believes in God. I'm the rabbi, but I'm the only one who believes in God.
I feel like the conversation about God has really been hijacked by people with complete surety about what they believe. And the idea of civil discourse, where I can say what I believe and you can say what you believe, and the goal is not for me to convince you to come to my side or you to convince me, but just to explore and ask questions and then maybe change our minds, that doesn't exist anymore. We're also busy, you know, trying to prove that we are right, and the way we do that is by proving someone else is wrong. Because nobody knows what God is. You can't prove it.
The God Upgrade is not a really long book. Is that by choice?
I feel like a book shouldn't have to be a career. You know, you should be able to sit down on a Shabbos and read my book and then have lots of time to think about it. And I like my books. My books tend to be smaller, so you can fit them in your purse or your backpack and take them with you. I like short chapters because people's lives are busy. I want them to be able to read a chapter and not fall asleep in the middle of it. You know, and it's, I think it's just trying to, my teaching style in general, I think fits the style of the day.
So the best place to find the God Upgrade is, of course, to call the same guy at Amazon who's the big aficionado of the Two Jewish Radio Show and get him to send it to you personally. But failing that, what's the best place to find the God Upgrade?
If you go to godupgrade.com, you can download a free chapter from the book, and you can see different reviews that have been written about it, and you can find lots of different places at which you can purchase it. And you can find more information about me at adventurerabbi.org.
Jamie, thanks for a great visit. I appreciate it, and look forward to what's coming next.
Thanks so much. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Next week, our guest will be DJ Schneeweiss, the Boycott Sanctions and Divestment Coordinator, that's BSD Coordinator for the Foreign Ministry of Israel, a fascinating and quite brilliant guest. Our playout this morning is also from Israel. Why not? It's the classic song Shir LeShalom, the Song of Peace. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
The preceding program was produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.